Ah, the Alexa Echo Dot. Something I've never had in the house before. This is someone sent me this as a present, but...
COVID-19 has been a crisis for the entire world and for most companies. And yet it has been a huge benefit for Amazon.
It's like a black fabric colored sphere with a little flat bottom. And let's get going. How do you ask it a question?
Amazon stock has risen by almost half. It's a $1.6 trillion company now. Bezos has added to his fortune. You know, as so many people are unemployed and in pain during this pandemic, it's terrible optics, but Bezos has gotten even richer.
Try saying this. Alexa, play music.
Alexa, play music.
Here's a station you might like. 90s alternative and grunge.
What is that saying about
Here's
me? 90s.
Here's something new I can do.
Oh.
I'm very helpful around the house.
They've worked really hard to embed themselves in our lives and in our physical homes. So I think that was really always Jeff Bezos' vision, is to make Amazon ubiquitous, to make it indispensable.
In the year that Amazon has become one of the most valuable companies on Earth, and its founder remains the world's richest person, what he thinks, how he thinks, has become a significant influence on the way many of us live our lives, now and perhaps well into the future. Alexa, what does Jeff Bezos think?
Jeffrey Preston Jeff Bezos is an American business magnate and investor.
Well, I must admit, I didn't know his second name was Preston. I could have looked that up. But Alexa, what are the main ideas inside the brain of Jeff Bezos?
I don't know that one.
Alexa, what are the main ideas?
Here's something I found on Wikipedia.
Okay.
Alexa is an internet service that measures how many internet users visit a website.
So that's not even you, Alexa, is it? It's someone else, Alexa. But we're interested in Jeff Bezos, Alexa. What are Jeff Bezos's
bigger... I don't know that one.
I hadn't even finished. Amazon is so much part of our lives, it's hard to imagine there was a time when it almost went bust.
And glitzy adverts that don't tell the story. Even mighty Amazon.com is losing money hand over fist. We'll talk to its founder.
Its shares fell 90% in 2 years as the dot-com crash destroyed many of the early internet businesses that had arrived in the 1990s to change the world. And people started to wonder if the big disruptor was about to become the big expirer.
People used to say Amazon is amazing, and now they say, isn't it amazing that Amazon's losing so much money?
Well, we've been Amazon.com, Amazon.toast, Amazon.bomb, and my personal favorite, Amazon.org, because we're clearly a not-for-profit company.
But to lose money when you've got 20 million customers takes real skill.
Well, we have that.
But one man was unfazed. Jeff Bezos, Amazon's founder, had little time for short-term setbacks.
What's really going on is we're investing.
His eye was and is always on the long-term future, the very long-term future.
Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff on Apollo 11.
When I was 5 years old, I watched what you just rewatched, and it had a huge impact on me. And it hasn't changed. None of that passion has gone away. This is me in high school, and I want to highlight this quote. The Earth is finite, and if the world economy and population is to keep expanding, space is the only way to go. I still believe that. And so today, I'm announcing that Blue Origin is founding the Club for the Future, whose mission is to inspire young people to build the future of life in space.
This man's ideas were formed decades ago, and a world away from the billionaire life he lives today. From an early age, Bezos was driven by the idea that every problem could be solved through thought and ingenuity. A quality he saw and admired in his grandfather, who he spent the summers with on his small ranch in rural Texas. Anything that needed fixing, they'd do themselves. They even rebuilt an old tractor together. And that conviction that there's no problem that can't be solved with enough thought and effort sunk deep into Bezos's nature. One day, his grandfather lost a thumb, ripped off trying to rescue his car when it rolled away down a hill after he forgot to put the handbrake on. As Bezos explained in a chat on stage with his brother at a conference organized by Summit, hospital doctors repaired it with a skin graft from his buttocks.
They take him back to the emergency room and they said, look, you have two choices. You're going to have a skin graft for that, and we can sew your thumb to your stomach and leave it there for 6 weeks. That's the best way to do it. Or we can just cut a piece of skin graft from your butt and just suture it on, and it won't ever be as good, but the advantage is your thumb won't be sewn to your stomach for 6 weeks. He said, I'll take option two, just do the skin graft from my butt. They did that. It was very successful. It worked fine. But the funniest thing about this story is that I have incredibly vivid memories, and we all do, of him, and he was, definitely his mornings were completely ritualized. He would wake up, eat breakfast cereal, read the newspaper, and shave with an electric razor for a really long time. Like, he would shave with that electric razor for like 15 minutes while he was eating his cereal. And when he was done shaving his face with that razor, then he would take two quick passes over his thumb because his thumb grew butt hair.
I met Jeff in 1995 when he was raising his first $1 million, and Jeff was struggling to do so.
Tom Ahlberg stepped down from Amazon's board of directors just last year after investing in and helping run the company from the very start.
Jeff is very engaging. He has his infectious laugh, which I liked.
Amazon, of course, began with books because he saw that an online store could stock every single book available, something not even the biggest bricks and mortar bookshop could get anywhere near doing.
His secret really was being that interface with the customer, providing an easy way for the customer to order it and then receive the book within a few days.
He has an astonishing emphasis on think of the customer, think of the customer, think of the customer. No one else, really. Did he have that right from the start?
In some ways, it seems like Jeff was born with a customer gene.
Bezos had swapped a lucrative job at a hedge fund in New York for a life of packing books on his hands and knees, all in the pursuit of a dream.
He does want to make a difference in the world, and in his mind, it translated into satisfying customers. And of course, that strategy is good for making money. And if you make money, then you can do more things.
Even now, Bezos' annual report is accompanied by a copy of his very first letter to shareholders to remind them that the ideas that drive the trillion-dollar company today are the same as those it began with.
Making very simple, precise promises and delivering on those promises day in, day out.
Doug Gurr is Amazon's country manager in the UK.
We have a very clear set of operational principles. There's four very simple principles, and they've been with us since, I think, the original shareholders' letter back in 1997. Customer obsession, a passion for invention, commitment to operational excellence and long-term thinking.
To deliver those principles, Bezos has built up Amazon as a kind of machine that continuously feeds back into itself. Retail analyst Natalie Berg.
If you can imagine a giant heavy disc or wheel that takes a lot of effort to get moving, once it starts to turn, though, it builds momentum, and eventually that flywheel becomes self-sufficient and it just keeps on spinning on its own. Jeff Bezos applied this concept to Amazon by relentlessly focusing on customers, by putting them at the heart of the business, that would attract more customers, more traffic to its site, which would in turn attract more sellers, which would mean a greater selection for customers, which again would enhance the customer experience. And it sort of continues to go around and around. As they grew and scaled the business, they were able to achieve better terms with their suppliers. Naturally, they passed on any savings and costs to the customer in the form of lower prices. And that also contributed to a better customer experience, and that flywheel continued to spin. And it's been absolutely key to their success.
Actually, it's not unique to Amazon. I mean, that might describe, for example, Walmart's approach. You know, what is it that makes Amazon so special, do you think?
Amazon is not actually a retailer. they sell a lot of stuff, but they are a technology company at heart, really passionate about inventing. They throw ideas against the wall and just see what sticks. So they're agile, they fail fast, and they try new things.
Bezos has always said that innovation comes from continually thinking afresh. Here he is again talking to his brother.
Inventors have this paradoxical ability to have that, you know, 10,000 hours of practice and be a real domain expert and have that beginner's mind, have that look at it freshly, even though they know so much about the domain. And that's the key to inventing. You have to have both. Yeah, I am going to become an expert and I'm going to keep my beginner's mind.
That rare combination marks him out. Looking at the business as if for the first time, Bezos decided to take a gamble on something that seems counter to all conventional retailing wisdom. During the dot-com crash in the year 2000, even Amazon needed a break to haul itself out of the tailspin in company fortunes that followed the bursting of the first tech bubble. And that was when Bezos found a novel twist to disrupt and then ultimately dominate retailing. Opening up the site to other sellers. Something that wasn't immediately welcomed within the company. Tom Allberg.
They made a decision to let other people sell books online and other products. And it was very controversial within Amazon at the time. If your job in Amazon was to sell books or clothes, and suddenly you've got to compete against third-party sellers, it was very controversial within the company. You know, Jeff was very motivated, had the insight that we need to treat outsiders the same as insiders. So suddenly selling goods was a platform. And of course, that's grown into more than half of their business. You have to speak your mind, disagree and commit.
This notion of having healthy debates, then making a decision and committing to do it. That's the opposite of what happens in most organizations.
One of the people leading that drive to bring other sellers onto the Amazon platform was John Rossman, author of a book about Jeff Bezos' methods, Think Like Amazon. He saw firsthand how Bezos' commitment to debate made a difference.
Most organizations, people don't actively debate. They kind of hold back what their real position is. They don't lead with customer obsession with data. They don't respect the decision maker. And when a decision is made, they're typically kind of passive aggressive if they didn't agree to the decision, right? They don't wholeheartedly buy in to making the decision successful. And so those simple notions of how we work together, I think, are really a big part of the secret of how Amazon works.
It all sounds very democratic. But according to Bezos biographer Brad Stone, it's often Jeff's decisions that are the ones that get acted on.
He has pointed out that there are instances where he disagrees and commits, you know, perhaps certain like TV shows that Amazon Studios has backed where he really didn't think it would be a huge success, but he kind of went along with it. So he's certainly willing to do it. But it's also true that in every meeting at Amazon, he's the guy who speaks last. He's the guy whose voice is the loudest, that carries the most weight. So it's more often than not that it's the other employees and executives who are disagreeing and committing to what Jeff decides and not the other way around.
And according to John Rossman, Bezos can have a short fuse for anyone who underdelivers.
He asked me, how many sellers have we launched since we launched the apparel market? And I started to explain that there really weren't sellers that we could launch at that point because we were waiting for new categories. And he interrupted me and he goes, the answer to that question begins with a number. And so then I started to give the number and he just was like, that's inexcusable. And he went off.
The Amazon marketplace, where third-party sellers sell alongside Amazon's own products, was an example of the company's flywheel in action. More sellers brought more customers, which brought better prices. And according to Sunil Gupta of the Harvard Business School, it also demonstrated how internal changes in the company could generate whole new products and services.
The way they work is work backwards and scale forward. Work backwards means you think about what the customers want and work backwards from there to say, how do we actually deliver those ideas and products? And if we don't have the skill, we build it. But once they build a skill, the other part of this equation is skill forward, which is once I have built a capability, how do you leverage that capability to get into completely new businesses? So for example, once I have created the marketplace, I now need to help my customers, these small and medium enterprises, to do e-commerce on my platform because they don't have the capability to do e-commerce.
Once you have other sellers using your e-commerce infrastructure, you've essentially created a platform, a utility even, for retail. Natalie Berg.
I think Amazon's goal is to become the rails that the retail sector runs on. And that's where if they continue to go down that path, they will run into greater government scrutiny and potentially in the future, consumer backlash.
And as the flywheel continues to turn, the back office functions that those retailers need, computing power and data storage, can be spun into yet another business, Amazon Web Services or AWS, that can be profitably offered more widely.
As I help those guys, I develop the skill, and now as a result, it becomes an AWS platform, which becomes a completely different business.
AWS is fast becoming the most used cloud computing service on the planet. Not just powering online retail, but providing storage and processing power for countless other sectors too. From software development, to broadcasting, to government data processing. Sunil Gupta.
Once it builds those skills and capabilities, it leverages those to get into a completely new business.
Some people might say there's a kind of jeopardy here, isn't there? Becoming too diversified, too fragmented, and losing a kind of core Amazon.
When I was studying a business, I was told strategy is all about focus. And this doesn't look like focus. So I tell my students the only explanation is Jeff Bezos missed that class. That's why he doesn't know what strategy is all about. Focus is by what is your core capability and what is the glue that connects all these businesses. The Prime Video makes no sense unless Amazon also has e-commerce business, because the purpose of Prime Video is to sell products on e-commerce. So once you look at the synergy and connection between these businesses, it makes perfect sense. The moment Amazon loses that synergy, then I think you will say, yes, it's a very diversified business.
That drive to move continually into new markets and new sectors requires a robust attitude to risk. Tom Allberg.
Jeff is also a believer that you need to take some risk with what you're doing. You can make mistakes. Jeff is of the view there are a few things in the world where it's hard to reverse the decision. For example, you know, Amazon launched the a cell phone. It turned out to be very unsuccessful. And they spent a couple of $100 million, but they closed it down and wrote it off.
You run into problems. You run into failures. Things don't work. You have to back up and try again.
Bezos again. At a conference organized by Summit.
We've failed so many times. I always think of us as a great place to fail because we're good at it. We have so much practice.
Alexa, how do you set yourself up?
No. House, the TV show, includes Teardrop by Massive Attack.
Okay, no.
House.
Alexa, just a second.
House
stop,
end
stop,
credits.
Stop.
And house
stop.
End credits.
Alexa, stop. Alexa, how do you embrace failure?
Here's something I found on the web. According to Byte.com, simply reminding yourself that failure is an important and necessary part of success rather than something to be feared will help you embrace it.
Wow, thank you. Alexa, hang on. That's almost...
Sorry,
Jeff.
I don't know that.
Another example of decision-making without knowing where it was going to go was Alexa.
Tom Allberg.
Jeff took that on, put a lot of money into it without any clear idea that it would make money, and made it a success. Sometimes companies embark on new projects, and if it doesn't work out after a year or two and they're losing a lot of money, they abandon it. Jeff is quite willing to take 10 years to make money on a new area that we go into. But if it looks like we're making progress, we're going to stick with it.
And, says Brad Stone, he brings to that vision a powerful competitiveness.
Apple had already created the Siri voice assistant that was integrated into iPhones. Google had a lot of strength in voice recognition. Amazon, by all accounts, probably did not deserve to lead in this category. But Jeff saw this as an important interface for how people control computers. He probably had a belief that this was going to be key to kind of connecting the home and all the appliances in the home. And he's not going to cede that landscape to Apple or to Google. Jeff was basically the product manager of Alexa. And in 2014, they released the first version. And in the snap of a fingers, the Alexa division inside Amazon had 10,000 people or more working on it because he doesn't want to cede that ground to Amazon's competitors.
The same competitive mindset seems to have shaped Amazon's approach to the two most populous markets on Earth, China and India. Doug Gurr was Amazon's manager in charge of China before his current posting in the UK.
There's a word we always say goes hand in hand with invention, which is failure. And the reality is, unless you're trying lots of things, you're not going to get the big successes. And, Amazon tries many, many things, and they don't always work. We tried lots of things in China. We've tried lots of things in the UK. Lots of them don't work, and that's fine. Unless you're willing to actually go in and embrace innovation, embrace experimentation, and accept that many of the things you try won't work, our personal view is you're unlikely to find a few things that do work.
Amazon's incursion into China wasn't the success Bezos had hoped for. It went too softly into the country and never quite established a foothold. And according to Tom Olberg, that's an experience the company has learnt from.
They've invested billions of dollars in India, certainly more than they did initially in China. If you're going to go in, you need to go in a big way. They're being quite successful in India. They may still be losing money, but they see that as a big opportunity.
Amazon is moving from the everything store to the everything company, a utility that will be everywhere in our lives, from books to food to cloud computing. And Jeff Bezos is the richest person in the world, which has prompted a lot of people to ask what he's going to do with all that wealth and power. One clue comes from a comment he made when he was given the Axel Springer Business Award in 2018, about how he sees himself looking back on life from the age of 80.
When you think about the things that you will regret when you're 80, they are almost always the things that you did not do. They are acts of omission. Very rarely are you going to regret something that you did and it failed and didn't work or whatever. But the acts of omission, the thing, I'm not just talking about business things. It's like, I loved that person and I never told them. 50 years later, you'd be like, why didn't I tell her? Why didn't I go after it?
And he's already begun to turn his attention to some of those things he's super excited about. In 2014, to the surprise of many, he bought the Washington Post, the major newspaper in the American capital. And one reason, as he told his brother in that relaxed chat, was because his father was a fan.
He was kind of a news junkie anyway, but he obsessively watched the Watergate hearings.
Do you think at some level that might have influenced you?
At least by the Post?
Yeah, I'm just curious.
It's hard to know. I bought the Post because I think it's an important institution. I would not buy a financially upside down salty snack food company. But the Post is a real institution I think matters and needs some runway. So that's why I did it. But did watching the Watergate hearings with Pop on the carpet have influence on that? Probably.
According to Emily Bell, professor at the Tau Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University in New York, it seems that Bezos has taken to his new acquisition.
He clearly saw some value in, I think, having a politically oriented news brand at a time when tech companies were facing a lot of regulatory pressure from Washington. And the second reason is that he's a businessman who likes long-term moonshot bets and has a very large amount of money with which to make those bets. And everything that one hears about Bezos is that he's actually really embraced it. He's really enjoyed hanging out with journalists, talking to people like Bob Woodward, Marty Baron, who's the editor of The Post. He's enjoyed participating in that world.
And it also seems to have given him more confidence dealing with the media. Bezos has been famously private when it comes to giving interviews. But when an American tabloid contacted him over pictures and information they said they had about his affair with another woman around the time he divorced his wife, he wrote a blog piece to call out what he saw as an attempt at extortion. Biographer Brad Stone.
He took the fight public. He's going to call out this behavior and put forth his point of view. And let's just admit, you know, it was enormously effective. It changed that narrative. People saw him as like, wow, you know, he called out this tabloid on their tactics and he defended a free press. You know, it's pretty admirable.
It established him as somebody who was not going to be bullied.
Emily Bell.
Before that, he was seen as actually quite a boring person. And you had this story of marital infidelity, these sort of racy pictures.
What's next for media mogul Jeff Bezos? Another acquisition, maybe?
Well, there have been a lot of rumors about his potential interest in CNN, which is the big global cable news network here. It would make some sense in that Bezos's interest is piqued by what's going to happen in the long-term future. There are questions at the moment over the sustainability and viability of television news services, in the same way that there were question marks over the sustainability and viability of newspapers 15 to 20 years ago.
How worried should he be about the regulators? Or is he in a kind of better place, if you like, to ride that one out than maybe other tech giants?
He's very unlike Rupert Murdoch, but he will have noticed that Murdoch's genius in the age of newspapers and television was really extending a global brand, becoming close to governments around the world, making sure that the regulatory environment was suitable for business growth, and leveraging those two things. And I think that there's a sort of a playbook in there which might actually appeal to Bezos.
Having stepped in to save a venerable newspaper, his sights now seem fixed on saving much bigger things. He started thinking about the future of the planet.
Jeff first contacted us in August 2019. He said that he wanted to do something very significant on climate change.
Tom Rivett-Carnac runs Global Optimism, the environmental group Bezos picked to be his partner in a lavishly funded set of initiatives to tackle climate change.
Honestly, the first thing we did was we asked a lot of questions, because at that time, Jeff and Amazon were not known for their leadership on climate change. And we wanted to be sure, if we were going to engage with them, that they were really serious about trying to deliver a major outcome. This wasn't just greenwash. And we came away from those discussions convinced that they were really serious and that they had the potential to really make a difference in this space.
Bezos came to the issue with both passion and a deep knowledge of the subject.
Jeff was extremely focused on whether his internal scientists had used the right figures to calculate the warming potentials of the planet over a 10 to 20 year period. And he really understood how the science that sat behind that could lead to different outcomes, and was delving in incredible detail into that with his scientists to understand if they'd really gotten it right.
It's tempting to be skeptical about Amazon becoming concerned with climate change. After all, its very essence is to encourage consumption. But Jeff Bezos has committed $10 billion to this cause. So is there something bigger going on here in his mind? A sense of civic responsibility, perhaps, that Amazon can be counted on to do the right thing, not just for shareholders, but also for the planet? Brad Stone.
When he said he liked to be counted on, he really was talking about, you know, the obligation that he had to his companies. As he's become the wealthiest man in the world, I think it's become clear to him, maybe later than it should have, that he has a wider obligation. You know, that Amazon can't just be a follower when it comes to kind of combating climate change. It has to be a leader. Amazon hasn't been a leader. You know, it was late to announce its climate pledge. But, you know, the way that this gets measured is through the contributions to the giving pledge, you know, this Warren Buffett-led pledge to give half your net worth to charity. You know, Jeff hasn't signed that pledge. His ex-wife, Mackenzie, has. So people are going to grade him harshly on his contributions.
Tom Rivett-Carnac has a more positive view. He sees the climate initiative as part of Bezos's ambitions about how he'd like to be remembered.
It did seem to me that it was a legacy issue for him, that he wanted to be on the right side of history.
And you don't think it's just greenwashing in the end?
How do you define that? I mean, would you define greenwashing if you said somebody got into this issue because they wanted to improve a reputation of a company or an individual, actually, that's fine, right? As long as they do something meaningful and deliver a major outcome. Some people would say it's a small proportion of his overall wealth. I actually think it's more interesting to look at it and say, this is likely to be the largest fund focused on climate solutions by a factor of 10 or 20. To me, that is a massive cause for celebration. It will improve the lives of people all around the world because we will be able to slow the climate crisis as a result.
For Bezos, though, saving the planet is not just about cutting carbon emissions on Earth. It's about something bigger.
There you go. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Exploiting the resources of space.
What happens when unlimited demand meets finite resources? The answer is incredibly simple: rationing. It would lead for the first time to where your grandchildren and their grandchildren would have worse lives than you. That's a bad path.
Speaking at the launch of Blue Origin, his space company, in 2019, he outlined his vision of how and where many of us could be living in the future.
The good news is that if we move out into the solar system, for all practical purposes, we have unlimited resources. Out in the solar system, we can have 1 trillion humans in the solar system, which means we'd have 1,000 Mozarts and 1,000 Einsteins. This would be an incredible civilization.
To truly understand Jeff Bezos, you have to see him not just through the lens of Amazon, but through the lens of space.
Christian Davenport, space reporter at the Washington Post, and author of Space Barons.
Jeff was the tour guide. He was the one who personally took us around for a number of hours, and they had set up at each stop, if you will, a subject matter expert, somebody who could talk about, you know, the engines or the manufacturing techniques. And invariably that person, a trained engineer, would get very deep into the details, and Jeff would sort of interrupt and translate that to lay people. So he obviously understood the mechanics, the rocket science.
Is there a future where, for example, Amazon might be making money from space exploration, from the exploitation of minerals on asteroids? And so on. You know, is this a business decision too?
It doesn't have to do with asteroid mining. I think, you know, at this point, that's still many, many years in the future. But it's with the launch of satellites and covering low Earth orbit with all these satellites that could then beam down internet signals to ground stations on the Earth, connecting the estimated 4 billion people on Earth who don't have access to broadband. That could be a huge benefit for Amazon. They could then be ordering products and services online from Amazon.
Bezos is channeling about $1 billion a year into Blue Origin. And his aim is to lay down an infrastructure that other innovators in the future can build on to achieve his visions of humans colonizing space. Just as the computer pioneers in the 1950s and 60s laid down the infrastructure for him to launch Amazon.
The price of admission to do interesting things in space right now is just too high because there's no infrastructure. In 1994, I started Amazon. All of the heavy lifting infrastructure needed for Amazon to exist was already in place. We did not have to build a transportation system to deliver packages. It existed already. Did we have to build a telecom network? That would have been billions of dollars. Infrastructure lets entrepreneurs do amazing things. My generation's job is to build the infrastructure so that you'll be able to. We're going to build a road to space.
That love of innovation, invention, creation, is at the core of what drives Bezos. In every annual letter, he reminds Amazon's shareholders that the company has to remain at what he calls day one, that lean, hungry moment where anything is possible.
What does day two look like?
I know the answer to this. Day two is stasis, followed by irrelevance, followed by excruciating, painful decline, followed by death. And that is why it is always day one.
And he won't tolerate disagreement on this from even his closest friends. Tom Olberg.
One time I said to him, we've accomplished a lot. We must be entering day two. And he turned to me and said, no, we're in day one. We're not in day two. We're still in day one. You know, it kind of offended his personal thesis. We've got a long ways to go. His worst fear is that his successor would not be willing to take risks and focus on innovation and invention, that his successors will not be bold enough.
Isn't the risk for Amazon, however, that what is now a company of 1 million people is still governed by the passion and drive of one man? Brad Stone.
Without the powerful impact, the daily impact or weekly impact of the CEO who can kind of peer into the future as he's done so many times and force new things, at one point, does this ever become a less innovative company? That's probably what I would say is Amazon's biggest threat.
Brad Stone isn't alone in fearing for Amazon should Bezos leave. What if an Amazon lost Bezos? What if Jeff Bezos left?
Oh, I totally agree. I mean, if a truck hits Bezos tomorrow, I'm selling my shares.
Sunil Gupta of Harvard Business School. Many CEOs have drive. Many have passion for the companies they run. But Jeff Bezos seems to bring something more to the table. That day one beginner's enthusiasm, combined with an ability to live in the long-term future. He's always been excited about picturing a solution to a problem we face today and working backwards to find ways to achieve it. Alexa, how can we see the future?
According to Bogleheads.org, the future is unknown and can only be seen in the rearview mirror.
Oh. Alexa, how can we use the rearview mirror to see the future?
According to Informer.com, it requires looking through the windshield and imagining a better future while also gaining hindsight by glancing at the rearview mirror.
Okay, we're in the driving seat of life. It's that ability to time travel while seeing each day as the start of something new that is key to Bezos' mind.